This is the second session of the interview with Hal Winsborough. It's February 1st, 1985, at 25 below this morning.
Yes. Looking over the outline of what we said yesterday, we wound up talking about the state of things when I arrived and the panoply of rising and dying institutions in the social sciences building. We were talking yesterday about the decline of Orcutt Enterprises with the pulling back of SSRI, the separation of DACC, the Data and Computation Center, and the Data and Program Library Service from the Orcutt affairs. And I think I was saying that the university was quite concerned about the latter two organizations, particularly the programming organization, losing a lot of money. And you asked about Elton Wock, and I said he was the dean's man. I don't know if that was literally the case, but he certainly was installed as a responsible character at the insistence of the deans.
The graduate school deans,
yes, who, and to some extent the LNS deans. I can't remember who was. Bob DeRemus was active at that stage, of course. He was still alive then. And Bob and Bernie Cohen were formed an alliance to insist that this enterprise shape up. And Elton was put in as a sort of the chief accountant. And he did it brilliantly and managed to handle both the accounting and the politics with great skill. So the way it looked in 1967 to a newcomer appearing here was that there was this array of institutions that people seemed to take quite seriously, and it wasn't quite clear why to the newcomer. And they seemed to be in considerable disarray, and there seemed to be a great deal of emotion about the whole thing, and it was quite unclear why, even if people told you stories about the Orcutt enterprises in the old days, why it was really hard to understand the panoply. Did I talk yesterday about the interdisciplinary thing very much?
No. You did say that the economists hadn't made use of it, but I'm not sure that wasn't after.
Whether we taped it.
I think it was off tape.
Well, on the chances.
Yes, as I was walking out the door, that's
we'll
right.
We'll repeat this anyway,
yeah.
If we did. My problem was to produce a demography center, and demography is inherently an interdisciplinary activity. The Population Association of America has lots of different folk.
Wait.
So we did do much of that about SSRI's owning interdisciplinary research. The Poverty Institute, which was quite new at that stage, very flush, had a lot of money, and was clearly a very lively organization as compared to SSRI, seemed to be the place where the economists were doing terribly well at that stage. The Poverty Institute had a very serious interdisciplinary character to it as well. It included a number of people from sociology, people from the School for Social Work, lawyers, and political scientists. Harold Watts was very good, who was the director at that time, was terrifically good at being sure that all these people got included in proper ways. It was clearly an enterprise that belonged to economists, but but was willing to dole out goodies to the rest of us lesser beings.
I have a comment there. Somebody said that if Harold Watts or somebody else had been the first director, there wouldn't have been such a heavy economic emphasis in the Poverty Institute. Because he was an economist, that there was.
I think that way. Well, I don't believe the premise. I don't think anyone else could have been the director of the Poverty Institute and had it go.
Oh.
It was the design of the thing was as an economics The whole idea was an economics idea. It always struck me as odd at the very beginning that it took the Johnson war on poverty phrase and stance very seriously, whereas my understanding had been that the war on poverty had been a way that Johnson could cope with the problem of providing services to the black population. That is, my understanding had been that in Washington, the war on poverty had initially been taken as a code word for let's do something for blacks. That Johnson had diffused in such a way as to include a reasonable additional constituency and set it up so that there was a lot of moral authority around it. And I can remember being quite surprised when I came here to discover that the Institute for Research on Poverty saw as its mission really studying the income distribution, and that to the degree that they were concerned about the racial segregation and economic inequity with respect to blacks was rather modest. It just seemed to me an interesting shift, and in that sense, it seemed to me the whole thing had been generated and sold to a part of the administration by Bob Lampman, as I understand it, as essentially an economic activity. And at that time, they were busy doing things that only an economist would think of doing, doing negative income tax experiments, which was the big deal at that point, to see how can we, by this manipulation of the taxing and the whole thrust of the concerns was, if we do a negative income tax, how much incentive do we have to encourage people to work, all of which is just very economic and quite dissimilar from the things that a sociologist might have thought of reading the political scene in Washington, I think, as it was really meant, about what are we going to do about blacks and what are we going to do about old people, who were the other major piece of the action. And it had seemed to me that this was a kind of a distraction into things that conservative objectors were up to the war on poverty were wrapped up in, like, what about the working poor? Well, there just aren't a lot of working poor. There never have been a lot of working poor. It's these people who have dilemmas because they're the wrong color, or because they're old, or because their husbands have left them, and they have a predicament for a year or two till they find their way on their feet. Well, anyway, so it was an economist game, and defined that way in both ends, in Washington and here.
It sort of interests me that you'd think about it, because you were in demography and thinking about birth statistics and death statistics.
Carl Teuber is, of course, one of the great experts on residential segregation in this country, we have a lot of the demographers have a lot of interest in studying social inequity. We do it very differently than the economist. Nonetheless, so it was an economist's game. The money wouldn't have come through in any other particular way, I don't think. And Harold was very generous and very satisfactory about Hoffman. And he was very helpful to the Demography Center getting going. But we were in a situation where a lot of people had apparently promised a lot of things and said, I want to be this, that, or the other kind of an institution. I want a recognized niche in the social space around here, and made promises about what they would do with it.
You're talking about SSRI
fashion,
people.
And the Poverty Institute was doing that as well, don't you see?
Yes.
At that time. And so I decided that the Demography Center should not do that. That we should, we had this history. Our name, we'd been named a long time ago. We shouldn't make very much fuss. We should try to keep a low profile and
you succeeded, didn't
grow
you?
and grow quietly and only let people know we were there whenever we were a serious enterprise. And so our task was to get to be a serious enterprise and not make a lot of fuss. And then whenever we had some serious substance, why we would go demand a certain amount of recognition. So we did most of our development. Most of the development of the Demography Center was done with outside money. It was many years into the development of the center before we started to ask for university resources of the sort that are commonly forthcoming to enterprises like SSRI. So SSRI dying had more university money in it than the Demography Center when the Demography Center was rising rapidly and doing many times the research business of SSRI. And we left it that way for quite a while.
It's fascinating. It certainly comes through in the interviews. It's just barely mentioned, the Center for Demography.
People don't know about it, yeah. Yeah. But it was intentional.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they don't talk about it.
Yeah. There's something I wanted to say in that arena. So our task was to get to be real and to demand our place in the sun only whenever we got to be real. And so we concentrated on organizing our training program, producing good students, and on going and getting federal money and doing good research. And to do this, we were able to be proceeded to hire through the Department of Sociology a lot of good demographers very selectively over time. And we proceeded to arrange it so they had as good facilities as we could manage here. But one of the reasons you don't hear about the Center for Demography is that it is entirely the creature of the sociology department. In some real sense, the Center for Demography doesn't exist in the university organizational chart. We have periodically fussed about whether we should get to be an institute or something like that. The problem with institutes is that it's very hard for a university to kill them off when they get bad or when they go away. It takes a lot of administrative effort to do that. And it's an embarrassment, as the decline of SSRI was kind of an embarrassment.
And you mean you would have made an effort to be an institute, but the university didn't encourage it?
No, well, the university certainly didn't encourage it, but we debated whether we should do it anyway at various times, and I'm sure we could have pulled it off. But we always concluded that we would rather not. These things come and go. University or research organizations like this come and go. And as you build them, you might as well be thinking about their demise. It is perfectly reasonable to leave an institution like this fairly fragile in an organizational sense, so that if it quits being real, it kind of goes away on its own hook, if you see what I mean. It doesn't take a big deal to let it go away.
Well, that's interesting. If you think of the Poverty Institute, which did lose its federal funding, but was supported by the university, was this because they had? Of course, that's not an institute either.
Yes, it is. Oh, it's an institute and
a
line item in the budget.
Oh, that's right. It's an institute for research and poverty.
Sure. So it has a line item in the budget, and is operated out of. It's out of LNS, right?
Yes, although the Chancellor's office was very concerned about it, too.
Oh, sure. But you see, what happened was that the university said, as far as I know, I've been on their research committee for quite a while now, so I think I know. Apparently the university said, okay, we will give you some money for a period of time, and you either arrange it with other funding or try to die quietly. And so the university was prepared to carry the organization for a while in the face of this massive loss of federal funding. And I think they would probably do the same for us. But if we went away, there wouldn't have, there isn't anything to get out of the budget or anything. And I'm not so sure how long I think a university ought to carry things like that. Now, the Poverty Institute's special because all of its money comes from one place in some sense. And we very self-consciously have not done that. As we set out to build a grant base from a number of agencies. So that I suppose one of the first very large grants was a a grant that Bob Hauser and Dave Featherman got. These were two young men that we hired. First we hired Bob, and then a year later the Department of Rural Sociology hired Dave. And Bob and Dave were both students of Dudley Duncan's from the University of Michigan. So we are generating now a real family enterprise here, where Carl Teuber and I were both trained by Dudley, and we were hiring a couple more of his students in Bob and Dave. We had already hired in the same, I told you last time that the same year that I came, why, Jim Sweet came as an assistant professor. Well, he was a student at Dudley's too, and and also Ron Friedman. So we were putting together this little shop that was like a collection of sibs of various ages, and my role was a avuncular.
See, you better than a young uncle. Yeah. But should you say something about the hiring? How was there agreement in the department that you should get?
Well, those were the days whenever things were very flush, and we were hiring 10 assistant professors a year.
By 69, they weren't so flush, though.
Well, we were still hiring a lot of people in 69. These people also looked terrific on the market. They're very, very promising, very polished people. And so the department wanted to hire them. And that continued. The department's interest in hiring such people persisted for a while, but eventually even very good people, we had enough demographers or demographic-like people, so that even very good people they wouldn't hire. Mm. But by that time we had a good coterie of folk. And
but Bob Hauser said that all he had when he was hired was his dissertation and I think one article.
And recommendations from people that said he was the best thing they'd ever seen. Huh. I mean, that's what he doesn't see. Is that, the recommendations from people that we knew and trusted were that he was terrifically good.
And rural sociology hired Featherman. Did you have nothing to do with it? I mean, did you propose his name?
Yeah, we sort of organized it, that they would do that.
Who's we?
I don't know, me and Carl and, who's we? I don't know, Carl and I sort of worked that, I guess. And Glenn Fugit. Glenn Fugit is a member of the Demography Center and has been, haven't mentioned him, but he's in the rural sociology department and very central member of our group. So Glenn saw this as an opportunity for rural sociology to get a terribly good person. Mm-hmm. And I think it was very good for rural to do that.
And David Featherman didn't mind coming into to rural sociology.
A little bit. It was an unfair thing. Bob came and gave his hiring talk here, after he had been teaching at Brown for a period of time. So he came in and gave a talk to the faculty with that kind of aplomb that somebody who's used to standing up in front of a class at 8:40 every morning and doing it more or less automatically, even if they don't feel terribly well or are nervous or whatever, has. Mm-hmm. Featherman, who came for a job visit here to our department and rural more or less jointly, as I remember it, had never been in front of a classroom. He was still a graduate student at the time and hadn't had that exposure. And his talk didn't go over terribly well. And that seemed to make a lot of difference in our department. I thought that was odd. That
they didn't make that allowance.
Yeah, they didn't make that allowance.
But they hired him anyway.
Well, rural hired him, but our department didn't, right?
Oh, I see. Yeah. He was considered for your department.
Yeah, our department subsequently ate crow and hired him from rural, as it were. And of course, he's one of our most distinguished faculty members at this time. So these two guys came, and Dudley Duncan and Peter Blau in the early 60s had done a large survey studying intergenerational occupational mobility. And if one was going to do another such survey to look at change in this issue to find out whether or not American society was becoming more open or less open, that is more mobile, was it more possible for the child of a low-status person to get ahead, why it would be useful to do another one. And that was attractive in the academic market, attractive in the intellectual world, right, in sociology. And so Bob and Dave decided they would do this thing. They were a little scared about the being brand new out of school, about how do you mount such a thing, but we provided a lot of institutional support for that in the Demography Center. And the fact that we were going to have this computer, or had it essentially in promise, and we're going to have it loomed large in the notion that they would be able to do this thing. So they got a very large NSF grant to do this, and this was a major piece of research going on in our center at that time. Carl Teuber proceeded to go ahead and get grants to continue to do work on residential segregation, and that was an important thing going on in the center. What else is that? Glenn Fugit, during this period of time, continued to work away on studies of rural population distribution, setting up a position in which, when it did become the case that we had this so-called turnaround, where non-metropolitan places started to grow faster than metropolitan ones, that he and his great colleague at Agriculture, Cal Beal, were going to be the ones to discover that. And so, in some sense, one of the things that in the 70s, mid-70s, helped us out a lot was that we had this kind of discovery here of a thing, and that isn't a phenomena that happens in the social sciences very much. Happens a lot in the biological sciences or the physical sciences. Somebody discovers something. Well, these guys discovered, as it were, this trend here, and that was a serious thing. It's kind of an interesting. Well, yeah, it's very taken very seriously. I mean, it's a shift of things from a very long run.
I mean, I didn't know that they had discovered it, that it was
a... It's interesting. We don't represent ourselves the same way that the physical scientists do.
Applies for a grant. Mm-hmm. Do you all have to talk it over and decide how you're going to allocate computer resources and whether you think they should do it? And
no, we don't do that, really. What happens is that people who apply for grants discuss it with people who may be collaborators on the grant. They will often ask someone else in the department to read the grant proposal, much as you might have somebody read a paper before you send it off. Nowadays, we ask them to check out the grant with our accountant, and the accountant sits down and asks them how much computing resources they're going to use and tries to be sure that they've asked for a sufficient amount of support in some sense for those things. But in the early days we didn't do too much of that. That is, it was just your due, and so you got it as you came along. One of the very serious facilities that the center provided was a routine way of processing a grant. That is, the facility was somebody who knew how you do it. Faculty members who knew what the agencies were like and what a grant proposal to this agency ought to look like. And then academic staff who knew how to get a grant through this administration. That's a serious business. If you've done it, it's and if you were an assistant professor, reasonably fresh out of graduate school, never really had to deal with anybody except the registrar's office and the graduate dean's office to try to figure out how to get a grant through, is a serious business. And the norms are weird. Everybody tells you that you must put the darn thing in like 3 months before you expect it to go out. So a lot of assistant professors will figure, well, I can never get it done that quick anyway. So they actually try to do that and put it in for a deadline that's long ahead. Well, then it goes through in the routine channels, and because it's treated as routine, it probably gets lost on someone's desk and never gets forwarded. So it takes somebody to know that, well, you know, you should track it from desk to desk in the university and to know when it leaves this desk to go to that one and keep track of how long it's been. So having people who know how to do that and know automatically that you've got to have this form, and if you want to telecommunications, you have to check it with this agency and so on, university. Big deal to know that. I don't know how a new assistant professor in a department that, or an enterprise that doesn't have folks whose business it is to deal with that, ever get any grants. The other thing that, the other facility that we provide that's deeply serious is people who know how to buy stuff. In recent years, particularly dealing with purchasing and acquisition of equipment has been a major headache. And it's required extraordinary action sometimes to get stuff done.
What do you mean by extraordinary action?
Well, I've had to arrange for the governor to sign off on computers that I wanted to buy twice. Okay? This is to give me special permission to buy the kind of computer that I wanted to buy because it was the only kind that was there. And so I've had to get the governor to sign off on a, as it were, a purchase order. And I mean to tell you, arranging for that is takes a little doing.
You want to say a little bit more about that? I mean, I would think it's surprising enough if you had to get the chancellor or the president to do it.
Signs for the chancellor and the president on an awful lot of stuff around here through purchasing or through the accounting office.
Right.
You see, so in effect, their authority is used. But there are a lot of rules about when do you have open bids for things. That is, when do you have an open competition for something? When do you let somebody submit bids, and when are you committed to take the lowest bidder?
Mm-hmm.
And if you are in a situation where that simply won't wash, that is, you want a specific piece of equipment for good and sufficient reason, who do you tell your good and sufficient reason to? Well, there have been times whenever the state law said that you tell it to the governor. And the governor signs a waiver of open bids, you see.
Well, so he has a special little branch set up recognizing that this is going to happen now and then. Do you actually go down to his office and ask for a 15-minute appointment?
No, never had to do that. Mm. It always gets handled through an assistant mm-hmm. of his, but it's not a special branch that handles it. Sort of one of his many assistants copes with this, looks into it, and often there's a little fuss about it. And so somebody calls you up and says, you say such and such, and Department of Administration says such and such. And you have to be prepared to win those. That's a bother.
Yeah.
It's a real bother.
Are you still doing that sort of thing even though you're not director and haven't been for some time?
Yeah, to some degree.
Do you have an official title?
No, I'm just I don't know.
They just come
to you.
It's
a very weird role. I mean, I have a very weird role in the center, which is very unofficial. And sometimes perhaps resent it, but
you mean because it takes too much time?
No, sometimes I resent it because it takes too much time.
Oh, you
sometimes
mean they
others
resent it,
resent
saying,
it because I will periodically exercise a certain authority that it's not at all clear I have.
Oh.
When we decided to get the vax, that was in, Larry Bumpus was the director of the center at that time. We were in the midst of this site review that essentially he was running. And I sort of unilaterally worked this deal with the members of the site committee that we would buy this particular machine, and then proceeded to sort of structure this whole array of decision points subsequently through the university approval arrangements and so on, and also the figuring out of how we were going to do it and what we were going to do, that we would get a machine of this kind and probably a vax. And I had no position that let me do that. I just did it. And Larry was right uncertain. He subsequently has said that it certainly was the right thing to do. But he was terrifically suspicious of whether we could cope with this new kind of machine and whether we wanted to move into the modern age. But it was really weird. I remember thinking about that, as I'm deciding to do this.
Yeah.
And I decided, and then it happened. And I had no authority. I don't know why that was.
So each of you independently had looked into what computer you'd get. He, because he was the director.
Yeah, he hadn't really. He was so. When Larry was director of the center, it was perfectly reasonable for him to let somebody else worry about the computing business, because he was unbelievably overwhelmed with other activities. At the same time that he was directing the center, which takes a fair amount of doing, he was also editor of Demography, which is the major journal in population work. And he was also the chairman of the grant review panel on fertility for NICHD, which was which in the way NICHD does things, it's a fair amount of work that he has to do. So he was unbelievably busy, overwhelmed with stuff to do. It was a real workaholic jag for him. So he didn't look into the computer business too hard, but was uneasy about it.
But he did, he must have been responsible for the grant request, I assume.
Yeah, sure.
So, and the assumption was that you were getting an IBM.
And he, of course, had acquiesced to doing it the way I wanted to. Because we changed it. We sort of submitted a revision to the thing to do something else.
And you looked at the grant request and said, what's going on here? And this, can't do this?
No, I think, didn't I tell this story last time that we had thought that we had structured the grant request IBM equipment, and because we thought that we would never get the agency to let us to do anything more ambitious.
That's right. It was when the site visitors came.
And the site visitors came and had a couple of good computer nicks on it,
mm-hmm.
Who were not demographers. Neither of them were demographers. They were computer types. Well, I told that story yesterday.
Yeah.
And at that point, they convinced these other guys that.
And for them, it was easier to talk to you because you knew more about it.
Well, they raised a serious question. They said, what the hell are you doing? Why are you buying this dinosaur? And we said, we're buying this dinosaur because your friends downstairs wouldn't stand it if we tried to do anything else. And they said, what should you get? And we told them what we thought we should do.
Yes, but that's the crucial thing, because you were the one who knew what you wanted to do.
Yeah, we knew what we wanted to do. What arena we showed ought to be exploring.
No. I meant you personally.
Yes, I knew what we ought to do.
So you've gone on in that what would you call it? A watchdog role or?
I don't know. My role has been, in part, to have a vision of what things might be like that's different than the way it is now, and then to sort of make it happen. And that just seems to be what my thing is. I'm not very good at running things on a routine basis, as a matter of fact. Much too sloppy for that. But my role in the center and in the department, to some degree, has been to have a reasonably coherent image about how things might be in the future, and then to sort of organize it and to mobilize activity to get there.
Like your undergraduate plan for your career.
I suppose. So. center has continued to expand. When we shifted and got the VAX, that became a very important thing. On the old IBM machine, it was a great machine for spinning tapes and collecting tables and collecting moments or something like that. But if one really wanted to do any very serious numerical analysis, the wherewithal simply wasn't there on the IBM machine to do that. When we got the VAX, of course, we got a machine that was fully capable of both doing all this data processing and a lot of communication and also doing the analysis. So that with the VAX, there were several important changes in the center. One was that more of the life of the center centered around the computer than was the case previously. The VAX has a mail system so that one can send mail from one person to another on the thing. I don't know if you've ever lived in that sort of an environment, but we arranged it so that there is a computer or a terminal on everybody's desk in the center, every faculty member's desk, and every student has easy access to one. So that people, instead of walking into somebody's office to deliver a message or writing them a note, which takes a while, and so on, just sends mail on the VAX. It makes for very rapid, very terse communication, so information flow in the center is very much more facile than it was before, although face-to-face contact is probably less, which is an interesting sociological problem thing. Also, people use this one machine for that kind of communication, for writing memos about department things, as well as for this elaborate data processing and for numerical analysis things. So all of a sudden, this becomes the a central tool that does a lot of things for you. And so the enterprise becomes a computer-centered enterprise in the way that one used to talk about child-centered families or dog-centered households or pet-centered households or something. old Everett Hughes remarkable old sociologist at the University of Chicago used to describe universities that way. Talked about the University of Chicago as a faculty-centered university. And talked about Duke as a founder-centered university, a donor-centered university. And the University of Wisconsin as a student-centered university. Well, our center became a computer-centered enterprise because that was just this kind of funny focal point. Remarkable shift. And made a great deal of difference in the social relations in the place. One of the things that people had to learn was what to do whenever they got angry. This is an interesting problem because the faculty are used to being very combative in print, because that's kind of, you know, you have these arguments with people in print and you get good at writing combative things in print. Somebody sends you a mail message and it makes you angry, and so what you're likely to do is to compose a reply, and as you compose that reply you go into your combative style in some sense, and people are very good at being very snotty about that. And I thought the place was going to come apart in the first several months because somebody would get mad and fire off this really nasty mail message to somebody else, and that somebody else would just be appalled, because often it was over a mistake or misunderstanding or something like that. So we had to kind of develop a set of norms that says if you receive mail and you're angry, you mustn't answer it right away. You have to wait at least an hour.
this was an anger that was expressed through the mail message that wasn't normally expressed if you stopped in at each other's offices?
That's right. See, people have
because of the writing.
Yes, right. I mean, if you get angry with one of your colleagues and you deal with them face to face, well, you cope with it differently, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You're not off by yourself. And most of us are not very good at getting angry with people.
Yes.
On a one-to-one basis. Used to be faculty were better at that. As a class, I think, it used to be in the old days that faculty members had this style of blowing up at students and so on, and putting on a considerable show of it, I think, but we don't seem to do that now. That's not part of the role.
When you say old days, what are you talking about? Your graduate student days?
Yeah, when I was a graduate student and people who had been graduate students sort of half a generation ahead of me would tell stories about being blowed up at in ways that was believable, but not really contemporary then. Well, anyway, I think we don't do that very well, but we're very good at doing it in print.
And these are all public, so everybody else can read them too?
Oh, no.
Oh, they're not?
No, the mail messages are very private.
Oh. I see. That makes it plausible.
Yeah.
I assume that everybody could read everybody else's mail.
Oh, no. That's the most private thing on the machine.
Yes.
I mean, you can send the mail to more than one person. Yeah. It just goes to the person, to the people you send it to.
Do you save them? Are they saved on tapes?
You can save them, yeah. You don't have to.
Do people do that?
No, it really does behave like one uses the computer as though it were a correspondence file or like your filing system.
Mm.
And so you throw stuff away just as you would in the filing operation because there gets to be too much of it.
But there isn't too much if the computer can always hold it, so I should think if you were at all historically minded, you might save them.
An interesting problem. Problem the National Archive is worried about. You may not know that, but
everybody's worried about it.
Are they in the archival business?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. I can see that one. You know what you could do? Most computer systems make backups. We do it daily to back up the disks so that if our major storage units die, have a power failure or something like that, we can put it back the way it was, like yesterday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it dies now, we can put it back the way it was about 8 o'clock this morning. And that happens every day. And you don't keep those things too much because obviously you wind up with an awful lot of tape that way. But it would be interesting, from an archival point of view, to encourage a sort of a sampling of those so that with a certain periodicity you ask that those things be archived.
Yes, it would.
You see what I mean? Because then you would get a cross-section of what's going on. Now, it would be a very different sort of a history than one did otherwise because you would have a cross-section of the action, cross-section of the state of things, the state of the paper. You will at a given time, and then say a year later or 6 months later, however you wanted to do it, you have this other cross section.
So the archivist and the archivist would have access to the personal messages as well.
Well, then I would think you would, after a certain period of decontamination time, as archivists frequently deal with anyway. Then yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
It's an interesting idea.
Although the same tapes might be filled with millions and millions of
pieces of garbage.
Yeah, data processing, I mean.
Hmm.
Oh, mightn't they? I mean, the same computer that's taking your messages is also taking your analyses of the...
Yeah, it has whatever one has saved. Okay, so it's what you have saved on a given day.
Hmm.
In relatively active memory. It's not bad, not bad.
Yeah.
So you would indeed find a certain amount of data there, and a lot of the space would be taken up with that data. It would be an interesting question as to whether the archivist would want to retain all of that, or whether he would want to sort through this backup file and dispense with some stuff and keep other things.
Mm-hmm.
Dispense with some stuff by simply describing it. Must be. Whenever one accessions stuff,
they always discard.
There's got to be a certain amount of discarding. Mm-hmm.
So that's really changed your lives, your professional lives.
Yeah, it's made a lot of difference in what communication is like. The other thing that has happened is it's made it possible for us to deal with people at a distance, because people can call in to our computer, and except for having to pay the telephone bill, it's very like they were down the hall. Rob Mayer deals with Chris Winship on a fairly intimate basis, and Chris is at Northwestern. And Larry Bumpus deals with Ron Renfus, who was a postdoc here for a period of time and went to North Carolina. And they communicate with great regularity. And Glenn Fugit has a couple of students that he's writing books with. Mm. And so they write on this machine and share text that way. So it makes possible a colleagueship extends beyond the boundaries of the building or the university. It also makes it possible to work at home.
Mm-hmm.
David Featherman now lives out by Mount Horeb and will be on the computer oft times from Mount Horeb and so on. So, as people take leave, this is getting to be a big deal. As people go on leave someplace, how do we arrange it so they still have access to the computer? It's getting to be a big deal. Rob Mayer was at the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Behavioral Sciences at Palo Alto last year and spent an awful lot of time on the telephone, talking to the computer and doing work here, and so on. Featherman has a student who is a colleague on a program projects grant he has from aging, and that fellow is in Israel. And we are in process of setting up a way where Featherman and this guy can both address, where this guy can address our computer,
yeah.
And so they can pass messages easily and so on, from Israel, from Haifa.
And this saves great quantities of time.
And, yeah. O.S. Sorensen, who is another faculty member that we hired, who was in the center very much. Oa was not a student of Dudley Duncan's, but of Jim Coleman's.
Who was considered for an appointment here once.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, we didn't have enough money. Chicago bought him instead of us. I mentioned Coleman in some other circumstance
yesterday,
but I can't remember.
He was the
guy who had a computer.
He was the first person to have a computer.
Yeah, that's right. He was the first.
He's mentioned in, I think, Carl Teuber's interview as being the person he took to the vice president of the system who didn't know who he was.
The vice president didn't know who Jim Coleman was.
It was an interview for his hiring interview.
Uh-huh. He was the only social scientist on the president's scientific advisory panel at that committee at that time, which was terrifically embarrassing to Carl, I'm sure. Oa was a student of Jim Coleman's when Coleman was at Hopkins, which was where Coleman had the computer, as a matter of fact. Oa has now gone to be to chairman of the department at Harvard. He was chairman of our department here, but never center director. But he now is going to be chairman at Harvard. And Oa has still a lot of work going on here, so Oa still is a regular visitor on our computer, and will retain an account and deal with us.
Has he just gone to Harvard?
Yeah, this last semester.
Oh,
yeah.
Because Harvard apparently is in a terrible fix, and is he hired there to fix it?
Yeah, he's hired to fix it.
Hmm.
He's in the process of doing it. My God, he managed to convince him, managed to convince the president ought to hire Theta back. you know, this big fuss that Theda Skocpol was denied tenure there, and she fussed about it as being a sexism, and it's taking them to court. And Bach, I think, has just decided that yes, they would offer her tenure. She was right, you know. It was. I don't know if she'll go back there. She's tenured at Chicago. Could be anywhere else. Well, anyway, so poor old Lola has to go cope with that. Are we winding down?
Well, we may be on this subject, although this is very interesting to find out how the computer is affecting lives. And I don't know, there must be other things that you could say about it. It occurs to me it may be a good idea that people can express anger to each other. Does it work that way? Or?
Well, it's better if they cool down a little, because it's a...
oh, you did say you thought the place would fall apart for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't...
You see, what happens is that people... I haven't expressed myself well about this. I think the dilemma is that people who are angry would go into a particular mode of writing.
No, you expressed
that was,
it well.
That they were comfortable with, and it was a very acerbic.
Yeah.
And they were very facile at it, so they would produce something that represented their anger in a more annoying way than they ever intended, and gave the impression of being angrier than they probably were.
Yeah.
Rather than cooling things, it tended to make them explode. This is really funny.
It's funny, Mike. When you brought it up, my impression was that there would be a great deal more humor expressed in interchange than there normally is when somebody comes in. At least, I've worked with a consultant at MACC, and all the everything is couched in those terms. Uh-huh. And
the main thing that happens is that people get. The main thing that happens is that people become. Feel fairly free to transmit information that they might otherwise not have transmitted, and they proceed to do it as tersely as they can, or just to do it. The thing that's neat is that if you think of something, if there's something comes up and you think somebody else ought to know about it, it is very easy to send them a mail message. It doesn't cost you much.
Yeah, it takes
and
no time.
It isn't very disruptive for them, because they don't have to stop what they're doing and cope with that right now, but they can accumulate these things and then go over them. And it won't take them very long to read it. If they're not interested in it, it's very easy to get rid of it, and so it's not particularly expensive either way.
Mm-hmm.
And so messages with a relatively low probability of being useful, a lower probability of being useful, get transmitted at a very low cost. And the net result is that more useful information gets shared around. Really.
To get onto the interdisciplinary, this is side two. The failure of that to work, and that you feel that the center does welcome and encourage people to use its facilities, and they don't do it.
Yeah. That's a.
And the question is why? Does it elsewhere, our centers, can people work together? Because if they can't, well, then it's not a particular problem here. But
there's a common wisdom that the university here is so department oriented that it is very difficult for someone to burst out of the department boundaries, and for interdepartmental work to flourish, because the department. Because things are so heavily departmentally oriented. And I suspect that there's a lot in that. The departments are one's major alliance, one's major attachment to the university here. I'm sure sheer size makes a great deal of difference. At Duke, a much smaller university, I had quite close collaborative ties with people in mathematics, for example, and also people in economics. Joe Spengler was in the economics department. Our center there was joined in economics and in sociology at Duke. And that was easy because it was small. There were relatively few sociologists, maybe 20. Well, here there are 65 or something like that. The demography center here right now is bigger than the Department of Sociology at Duke. There are 20 faculty members associated with the demography center. There are like 70 students or something associated with it. Maybe that's too many. But a lot as big as that thing. So that there is to some degree a problem about kind of the opportunity structure for striking a contact, I think.
Yeah, that's one thing. That's where two individuals get together and talk about their work. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah, that's where
really. I would happen to be thinking of whether an economist could come down here and say, I have some data I need to process.
Sure.
But your point's more interesting. Well, I mean, you're saying the economists don't do that.
Yeah, that the economists don't do that very much. And I don't know why. Hell, it's free.
You must have some speculations as to why.
Well, let's see. Glenn Kane is a member of the Demography Center and has been forever. Glenn is writing a census monograph from the 1980 censuses right now, which involves using 1980 summary tapes, public use sample files. I suspect Glenn's students have been having to process those files on our machine. But Glenn hasn't kind of come on into the technology of it and done it the same way
that others. So he doesn't know how to do it. Is that it?
So he probably just doesn't know how to do it and probably doesn't figure to learn very much about it. And maybe his students don't know much about how to do it, and they also aren't fixing to learn much about it because it doesn't seem like something they're going to do a lot. Can't think why that would be. I suspect,
So it's the element of mystery of how it's done rather than an unwelcoming atmosphere and here.
Perfectly welcome. All right, that's a good thing about that. I mean, your point is well taken. Mansky. Charles Mansky, a new, relatively new econometrician here, who is apparently a very distinguished econometrician, asked if he could use our machine early on because he uses the kinds of data that we have to do his econometric work with. And we arranged for him to have access to our machine. He uses it routinely. He's quite a capable computer person, writes programs, his own programs, to do his own special. He invents a statistic and writes a program to do it and then analyzes data using that and shows that it's all better somehow. He uses the machine a lot. It's easy for him somehow, and it's fine. And we all think that's lovely. And he pays us off by doing two things. In the public papers that he publishes, he cites that he did it on our facilities, which keeps our granters very happy. Mm-hmm. He also puts the preprints of his papers in our publications series. We have a working papers series, and we send quarterly, I guess, a list of all the papers that are available to people, and then they can request such of them as they want. So he adds that his stuff to our list, and we distribute his papers, which is, in a sense, a service to him because he doesn't have to worry about keeping them in print, as it were. But it's nice for us because then other people know that Mansky's doing his thing at our center, and they also find out about his thing, which is important stuff to know. So it's very
And
profitable.
He doesn't have to pay for the computer time?
No, our computer time is entirely free. That's another trip, isn't it? Okay.
Yeah. Yes, that I see. That is astonishing.
We give it away. It's free.
And there's no pressure on you on the particular machine. I mean, there's always enough space.
Sure. Yeah. That's right. If we run out of space, we go get some more space.
Yeah.
And we get more space because people find it a useful thing to do, and so they cough up some money But for specific things, more disks, more of that, another computer, whatever. So it's, as I say, it's a producer's co-op.
Okay.
In some sense, and you use it as you need to use it, and you kick into it as you can do so, and there's felt need.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, and it's free. And now why wouldn't a bunch of economists come to a free good? Now you tell me that. Gene Smolensky always says there's no free lunch. I suppose that's, and he's probably right about that, that eventually we tax people because we ask them to come help us run this producer's co-op.
Mm.
Or we run the risk of doing that. But you do that, to the degree that you want to.
But from what you say then, it must be people's not knowing how to do it.
That, I think, is part of is a big part of the thing. Now Martin David is coming on in, and Martin is very capable, and will shortly know how to do everything that's necessary. So I suspect Martin will really kind of come on in. I think there may be some boundaries that get drawn that the faculty don't know about. I mean, the faculty in the center don't know about. I know that our librarian, Ruth Ellen Sandor, can get very upset about economists coming down and running off with our current population report series. This is one of those awful government documents, serial publications, where each item in the series is numbered but has no other predictable thing about it. The titles vary from year to year and item to item, and they're issued irregularly, and their current population report series P23 number such and such, okay? And so we get all that stuff, and Ruth Ellen keeps good care of it. The people, the eighth floor library is supposed to get all that stuff too. A reasonable number of economists, often ones not associated with the center, come down because Ruth Ellen runs a very nice library, thank you. And she has it, and upstairs they're likely not to have it, not for anybody's fault, but because nobody is putting money into the thing. And she worries about those things.
That's
wandering.
The data and computation library.
No, the eighth floor. On the eighth floor, there is a print library, which is called the Social Sciences Reading Room.
Oh, okay.
It is now a member. It is now an offshoot of Memorial. It didn't used to be.
All right.
Okay. It's one of those weird things. But it's a reading room.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a print collection. So Ruth Ellen will be concerned about people, economists, people from other departments, coming and getting rare
documents. She wouldn't mind if it were sociologists.
Yeah, she minds sometimes if it's sociologists, particularly if they don't bring it back. But she thinks she loses more of this stuff to economists. But that may be paranoia, you know, I mean, sort of a difference of kind. And I suspect that it's like a lot of these stereotypic things, there's a certain element of truth in it. An important thing about the way we run the center is that the center, I said it's a producer's co-op, but it's also like a commons that we all have a stake in. And it is easier to be relatively open and free with people who share your stake in the commons and who are going to try to preserve it one way or another. And that becomes a problem about dealing with things our way. I turn back CPRs because I'm going to want them to be in that reliable place the next time I want it, in some sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
All right. Well, how about talking about the 40-50 census?
40-50 census.
What time is it? Oh.
Okay, we can do this a bit. Well, that's a long story, and a complicated one, and from my point of view, kind of a tiring one. I mean, that project made me very tired. I guess we began to be involved in that project initially in something like 1972.
Now, you know you have an account of it, the paper that was given in Michigan.
No, I don't remember about this paper. Which one? Did I write this?
Yeah. it's on.
About 1972, at a meeting of the Population Association in Washington, I think it was 72, at the Shoreham, Carl Teuber and I got contacted by a person from NSF, a man named Jim Cowig, who was an NSF official at that point, probably part of the RAN, R-A-N-N group, at the time. And Cowig was a kind of a distant kin of ours, one way and another. He wound up married to Leo Schnorr's first wife at some point in time, but later divorced her, and he had written papers with Dudley Duncan and so on. So he was kind of a member of this extended family that we have in a slightly distant way. Jim was interested in whether or not we shouldn't make public use samples from the 40 and 50 census, and I'm not going to talk about what public use samples are because that's all written down someplace. Whether we shouldn't make public use samples from 40 and 50, and it was going to be a big deal, and it needed to be done sort of jointly with the Bureau and somebody else, and he thought NSF would be interested. And so he sort of jacked up Carl and I, invited Carl and I to get together with people at the Bureau and see if we couldn't find out how much it would cost and write a letter about this. Well, I think that Carl and I fiddled around for a little while. Carl's father at this point, God, this is family business. Carl's father was the associate director of the Census Bureau at that time, the senior civil service person in the Census Bureau. So we talked to Con Teuber, Carl's father, and after a while arranged to have some meetings with people at the Census Bureau about doing this. It took all of us a little while, and particularly people at the Bureau a little while, to figure out what one might plausibly do. And we had some meetings, and they eventually produced us a series of cost estimates for what ought to be done and how to do it. And I think at about 74 or something like that, then Carl and I wrote up a lengthy letter to Jim Cowig and to, I don't remember whether it went to Don Plock, who was the sociology person at that time, or not, but maybe not. Maybe it went to Cowig. Can't remember. And included these estimates. Now, Cowig had told us that we ought to write this up as though we had specific research that we wanted to do with this data. Mm-hmm. And we told Cowig that that was dumb because it was going to be very expensive and no single research project was going to make it worthwhile. But we could describe things we wanted to do, so we did it that way. So we wrote this long letter. It was, I don't know, a 30-page letter or something, and included the Bureau's estimates of the costs and so on. Well, great silence, and then we got letters saying, this is just much more money than we were thinking about. Well, what the hell were they expecting? I don't remember how much it was supposed to cost then, maybe $2 million.
2.7.
Is that what I said to start with, 2.7, something like that? Cheap at the price they should have bought right then, I'll tell you. And so they decided that no, they shouldn't, wouldn't do this. And I was quite annoyed because Carl and I had spent a good bit of time getting it together, and I had written the majority of the letter. The way Carl and I intend to work is, Carl is a brilliant editor. He's a beautiful writer on his own hook, but he bleeds. I think anybody is a brilliant editor, so our working arrangement has for some years been such that I write a first draft, and then Carl tears it apart, and then I put it back together again. And we go through a couple of cycles like that, and it produces pretty good prose. We had done that. And at that point, there had been some other groups involved one way or another. Quite who, but we had friends and relations that we needed to let know about what the status of things was. And I had told Carl at that point that I thought probably we ought to execute a quit claims deed to the idea. At this point, we had done our thing. We had gone through this, written it up. If at some other point it was possible to get it done, why, I was concerned that somebody would decide that we had prior claim to it and they shouldn't do it. So we ought to say, if you want to do this, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Carl said, maybe we shouldn't do that. Just leave it be. Maybe he thought that was seemed, pompous to do that. Perhaps. So we didn't do it. But then a couple of years later, the idea reoccurred for reasons that are described in the paper that you have there about such matters. Don Plock approached us again saying, do you want to do this? And Don at that point had an alternative strategy. Now the interesting thing about this is really agency people trying to figure out how to do something that they know full well the discipline thinks is very important to do. There's a lot of reason for anybody with their head screwed on right to know that the discipline thought this was a useful thing to do. Official groups had declared it to be useful. So agency folks kind of snoop around and sort of figure out, well, how the hell could we get this done given the structure of our agency and what's hot and so on, what our mandates are and what our rules are. That's why Cowig had told us to make it look like it was a research proposal of ours, because they thought they could fund it under the rubric of an individual research proposal. The thing that had changed was that there had been a committee which had made reports about the scale of funding in the social sciences, which is sort of recommending kind of capital investments without in social science resources, which didn't necessarily need to be tied to any single project, but demonstrably of importance to a lot of projects. So Don Plock, who ran the sociology panel at NSF, came to us and proposed that he give us a grant, in effect, to hold a conference and put together a bunch of stuff about what might be done if this was there. That to be the basis of the argument that there was not just one project, but a lot of things that would be usefully done. We thought long and hard about whether we wanted to do this and decided that it was our responsibility to pursue this, that we were elected in some sense, because this was not, we knew ahead of time this was not going to be fun, and it wasn't. We held a conference. We did this in alliance with Bill Mason at the University of Michigan. Bill was the chief proponent. He had been elected to get Census Bureau to release the March current population surveys in a more or less coherent fashion and to go back and release them as far back as possible. So he was supposed to put forward a proposal to do that, and we were supposed to put forward this proposal, a 40-50 proposal. Maybe they were supposed to be joint, maybe they weren't, but we were supposed to have a conference in which we talked about these things as a group. So we had a conference, and it was a terrific conference, and we got all our friends and relations to come. And we published a little book, which you should get if you don't have. I mean, it's a paperback thing. One of our publications, we've never published it as a book. It's called Old Data for New Research.
Oh, yes.
Do you have a copy of Old Data for New Research?
I've seen the title.
Yeah, okay, well, we should find you one. That volume, that Old Data for New Research thing, really became the basis for justifying the proposal. It said, here's an array of things that these scholars, 25 or 30 of them, say they will do with these data. Mm-hmm. So that if you invest in this, you won't be throwing your money down a rat hole, buying something that nobody ever uses. Now that was serious business, because NSF had invested a reasonable amount of money at one time or another in data archives that nobody ever used, and spent a good deal of money prettying up a bunch of particularly political science data that was utterly boring. I mean, apparently nobody ever used it. So there got to be a real sensitivity about whether the well, the relation between what seems the obvious and apparent use of somebody else's data and the real outcome. So out of this grant proposal, there is out of this conference, at the end of this conference, the conference was attended by NSF people and Census Bureau people and a whole lot of folks. And out of that, we were told that we should put forward a proposal, as it were, for a pretest to find out how much it was going to cost, because by this time we had changed our mind. By this time things were wildly different in the Census Bureau. Con Teuber was no longer associate director. We were in the Nixon years, and in the fashion of the Nixon administration, he was taking over the bureaucracy. So the Census Bureau was a very different animal than it had been before. Very concerned about paying its way, and so on. And very much less of an academic enterprise. What was really happening in the Census Bureau, partly was Nixonized, but partly also the generation of social scientists who got their PhDs in the early part of the Depression and went into the Roosevelt administration as bureaucrats and made the social science statistical system, federal statistical system, as it were retiring. And so there was just a shift in the, frankly, the intellectual quality of the people who were there, and also their capacity to stand back in a somewhat academic way and look at what's the use of all this anyway. If that makes sense.
Yes.
So it's really a serious, a very serious shift, and it happened about that period of time during the 70s throughout the federal government. And it portends non-trivial trouble in the long run. Now, so the Bureau people were there. It wasn't at all clear by this time that we wanted to do this thing the same way that the Census Bureau had originally said we wanted, that they wanted to do it. But we should have a pretest. That was what Plock said. And I think this was a kind of a let's go in piecemeal. We'll give you a little money for a conference. You have a conference and justify it. Now we'll give you a little more money and you kind of pretest this thing and tell us how much it's going to be and get everything worked out. And that we can think of as kind of researchy. And then there's a production grant to really go ahead and do it. That was his notion. So we wrote a grant proposal. It was that way. That damn grant proposal was reviewed by 75 people. I got, at one time or another, 75 reactions to that grant proposal. In waves they came, and we were asked to reply to some of them. And it went on. Getting that grant was a real deal. I mean, it just went on and on. By and large, the responses were favorable to what we wanted to do. At some point, the NSF changed its mind and decided they didn't want to do this in two different phases. They wanted us to rewrite this, to do it as one whack.
Why were there 70, why so many?
Well, it was
they were afraid of making a mistake? And
yeah, it was risky business, and they wanted to be sure that all the bases were covered.
Yeah.
And they had touched base with everybody, and I think every time they would get a series of these, get a series of them in, why they that series would suggest other people that they ought to do. And I think also probably some, the issue became one of where are we going to spend a lot of money?
Yeah.
And so there probably was a certain amount of competition that way. And it was unusual. It was new. Nobody had ever done this. Oh my God, we were asking for $7.5 million by the time we were done.
Yes.
And that was a lot of money. And it was a big deal. I think that it was at the time the largest single thing that NSF had, social sciences, had put its money into. Now, since then, there may be something that's bigger. And surely there are continuing things, like the presidential election studies that they have supported at ISR every 4 years, survey operations from time immemorial. I'm sure there's more money in that. And the panel study of income dynamics, the Morgan thing, they've put more money into on a kind of a continuing basis. But I think this was the largest single thing. This was a big deal. They also kept threatening to cut our budget. And that was very difficult because the Census Bureau had made an estimate of what they thought it would cost. And it was an estimate, if you see what I mean. That's what they thought it would cost. And we weren't going to pay them that and then they do it. We weren't negotiating a price or anything like that. We were going to have to, they charged time and materials, as it were, and overhead. And it cost whatever it kind of cost, in some sense. It didn't make any sense then to lower this budget and say that the Census Bureau estimates differently. Our part of the budget was minimal to start with. I mean, the part that we were going to spend here at Wisconsin was minimal to start with. I mean, if I were to do it again, I would have insisted we have a larger piece of money here because we didn't have enough to keep track of. We weren't spending enough money to monitor the very large quantity of money the Census Bureau was spending. Anyway, we finally got the full thing funded for the full price whenever we told them. It finally only happened when we told them, all right, enough already. We've messed around with this for 4 years of our lives trying to get this thing, and you keep telling us you're going to give us less money or you have to review it by somebody else. Give us this much money and do it now or quits. I'm afraid we just did that. It's easy to do that on such a thing because this is not a lovely thing to do. I mean, this is, you're elected to do this thing. You're kind of elected to go burn yourself, if you see what I mean. And if somebody gives you an opportunity to back out, you might just as well use it. But they understood that we had them, and so they didn't, unfortunately. So we went and did. And so we did this thing. And it was a big deal. We bought a computer, and we installed it in Pittsburgh, Kansas, which is the archive that keeps the microfilm of this material. Mm-hmm. And also a terrific labor force, clerical labor force. Lots of very good types.
Did you have to go down here?
Occasionally. Come in.
Okay. It's tape four.
Okay. Pittsburgh, Kansas. The production operations went on in Pittsburgh, Kansas, because the Bureau had an archive of microfilms of old census data there. And it turned out to be a great place because the labor force was terrifically good. We got very good typists who worked very hard and at GS whatever wages that we paid them, GS-5, whatever. It was a complicated, very complicated enterprise to run. The way it was supposed to work was that we figured out what the Bureau was supposed to do, we told them what to do, they did it. The people that we told were in Suitland, Maryland, at the Bureau's home office, and the Bureau then told the people in Pittsburgh what to do. It got very complicated. It became clear by this time, it was our contention that the most reliable way to get this material from the microfilm into the computer was essentially to have people key it into a terminal attached to a computer. The Census Bureau's traditional way of doing this would have been to copy it down from the microfilm in hand onto coding sheets, send those coding sheets to their key punching operation, which of course now was keying it into a machine in someplace else, Indiana someplace, I've forgotten where, interposing thereby a step of transcription that you had to pay for and where errors were had a non-zero probability of occurring. And we thought it would be better to have people type it, key it in some sense directly from the microfilm, to be able to put the checks in for what things were there and to not let somebody go on if they messed up, and could go directly back to the original document. So the first part of our project was a kind of a test and costing thing to figure out which of several ways of doing this was cheaper. And it worked out that we were right. It was much cheaper to key it this way, and it was much cheaper to, and the error rate was much lower. But so the project began with a fight with the Census Bureau about how to do it, which we won, not because we could have won it by power, but because we were right. In order to do all this, then, we had to buy a computer, which we installed in Pittsburgh, and a lot of equipment. And it was installed in this place, which we couldn't get at. The material was still protected by confidentiality laws, so we couldn't really see the data. We could not arrange it so that we had direct access to that computer in any way. So the Census Bureau ran the computer from Suitland, and then we had so the people in Suitland who were running this part of the affair talked to the Pittsburgh computer, and then they also talked to the Demography Center VACS, mm-hmm. so that whenever they wanted to send us data, sometimes it would go from Pittsburgh to Suitland and then Suitland to us, and sometimes they would just make a tape and send it to us. So we had this kind of running dilemma about this three-legged dog that we were trying to make run. There was the fourth leg, that was the NSF, which gave us fairly little trouble periodically. The NSF is always very good. It's probably the nicest agency in the world to work for, to do research for, because they understand what you're up to and keep appropriate track of you. We had an advisory committee that met regularly to see that we were doing things right, a very distinguished bunch of people on the advisory committee. And so NSF was very helpful. After we'd figured out what to do, and figuring out the sampling was a serious problem. I mean, it needed to be done very carefully. We luckily figured out a device whereby we would draw the sample. How do I want to say this? In addition to the serious sampling problems, which you can read about, mm-hmm. we also concluded that it would be a good idea to, as it were, pass through the microfilms in a tidy fashion. All these schedules exist on microfilms. We decided that, in addition to everything else, we would pass through the microfilms taking a cluster sample of reels that would be genuinely random in such a fashion so that if everything went bananas in the midst, we would still wind up with a sample of a smaller size and not as efficient a sample because it would be a cluster sample. But that we could, if something went wrong, we would always be in a position to retrieve a national sample of this. Turned out to be, it cost very little to do that, but we did think to do it. I was enormously relieved that we had managed to think to do that when the Reagan administration began, because in the first year of the Reagan administration, there was a great rescission of the NSF budget, and we had to take our share of it, and by that time, all of the discretionary things had been spent. That is, we had decided to do it in a particular way, and we were into the production phase of this activity. And so how are we going to do? Well, what we did was use the clusters of 1940. We got through 16 of 20 of these replicates, cluster replicates. We then stopped in 40 and slimmed down the 1950. We hadn't begun 1950 yet, so we slimmed down the sampling fraction in 1950. How are we going to make the savings? Cut the sampling fraction. Yeah. That way. It's all right. So we cut down the sampling fraction in 1950. And then we went through 1950 and found that we had enough money. We had had more savings in 50 than we had expected to have, which partly was a learning curve on everybody's part. And we then were able to take the money and finish up 40.
So it's done.
Yeah, we did what we promised we would do.
But you said it was
and
tired.
We had,
what did you mean?
Well, it just went on forever in the Census Bureau. A year and a half into the thing, why we had been telling the Census Bureau, please do this, please do that, nothing had happened. The Census Bureau sort of never got going on anything. And I was about to throw in the towel at that point. And several things happened. A fellow that we were dealing with got kicked upstairs, that is promoted, and we got somebody else, and that somebody else seemed to be more of an active person. The other thing that happened was, I think I found out how you deal with a government agency of that sort. You come in the middle, you see, of a chain of command, and the person that you deal with, in part, regards you as his boss, which is what this person was supposed to do. But it became necessary for us to figure out what his boss does, and to do sort of precisely what his boss does in terms of handing him work. So we started drawing PERT diagrams, Gantt charts and all that stuff, to say here's what has to be done and here's when we expect it to be done and here's the time flow of things. And when presented in that form, as opposed to a set of memos that contained very much the same information,
yeah.
All of a sudden things happened. Mm. It's just very strange. It had not dawned on me. It's very different in the academy. We persisted for quite a while. We dealt with the people in the Census Bureau as though we were dealing with colleagues on a research project. In the academy, it won't work. But the problem is, how do you deliver orders? But we had no real authority to deliver orders, you see, because we weren't their boss.
Yeah.
We were this, you see the problem? And
yes.
Finally, we figured out a vehicle for communicating, which seemed to work beautifully. From then on out, everything went fine. We would communicate our orders in that form.
How do you account for that? Does the bureaucracy take better to charts? Or?
I have no idea. I just don't have any idea. I think what we did was just unrecognizable. I think they didn't recognize these memos we were sending as instructions. I don't know. There's a good... I think that in the academy we tend to expect that people read things. And I'm not real sure that in the rest of the world a lot of that happens. Well, anyway, so we had to learn how to make the bureaucracy go. We finally did that. And it just went on forever. So there was a year and a half delay right at the start.
Mm.
And then all of these deadlines failed. And there didn't seem to be a damn thing we could do about that. So it just dragged and dragged and dragged and dragged. And it would always be such that it would drag forever, and then when it was our turn to do something, we had to do it very quickly to keep on schedule. So one was in a situation of, one's life was utterly unplannable.
Yeah.
And it also had disasters that would show up. The budget would be cut, the disk drive would die, things like that. We sent it. We bought a new disk drive, which we had delivered here for some reason, because it was cheap or something. Then we trucked it down there. It fell off the truck. And it had to be there. We had to have it in operation at a particular period of time. And how to deal with the insurance business to get this disk drive repurchased and delivered in 6 months. The university's self-insurance really works. The insurance office here, luckily the administrative assistant on the project done everything right about that.
Mm.
But the risk management coped beautifully. They produced this. We had another disk drive installed a month after the disaster, which wasn't too bad. But it went on and on and on and was terrifically grueling.
You know, I have to turn this off.